Well, welcome to Watermark this evening. This is an event that we are thrilled to host with some friends that have literally flown in from all over the world to be with us this evening. And we're going to enter into a conversation about creation, a conversation really about origin and about design, about the prevailing theory of the age, which is Darwinistic evolutionary theory, and what is commonly called intelligent design. We're going to define that for you tonight. And we're going to talk about some basic implications. What we're going to do is introduce you to three primary participants, Stephen Meyer, Michael Behe, and David Berlinski. And we're going to give you a chance to hear from each one of them. We're going to introduce each of them with a little video vignette and then let them speak on their specific area of passion in this particular conversation and let you know their contribution to the discussion between intelligent design and other theories of origin. Those of us that were here this morning heard a little bit from Dr. Meyer, but I'm going to go ahead and let this video serve as a catalyst to reintroduce him to those of you that were not here with us this morning. And again, we're grateful that you're here. I appreciate the grace you're going to extend to one another as we are at capacity, and we hope that this evening is useful to you as you wrestle with truth. So here we go.
The discovery of the information-bearing properties of DNA and RNA is a fundamental challenge to all materialistic theories of the origin of life. Neo-Darwinism and its associated theories of chemical evolution and the like will not be able to survive the biology of the information age, the biology of the 21st century. According to a lot of the mainstream media, the theory of intelligent design is a faith-based idea. And in saying that, they want to dismiss it as something that has no basis in science. But the media has confused a fundamental issue. They're confusing the evidence for the theory with the implications of the theory. The theory of intelligent design may well have implications that are supportive of theistic belief, but the theory is not based on theistic belief. It's based on the discovery of digital code in cells, miniature machines in cells, the fine-tuning of the laws of physics and chemistry, and standard ways of scientific reasoning about the remote past in the history of life.
Hi, I'm Steve Meyer, the guy that was just talking. my job tonight to start is just to give a short introduction to the theory of intelligent design. We just, first of all, want to define what it is. And then we'll have two talks, one by Mike Behe, and then I'll be back again to talk about some of the evidence. So we'll have two talks making the case for intelligent design, but first I want to give a little bit of an introduction. 2004, the British atheist philosopher Anthony Flew made worldwide news when he announced that he no longer accepted atheism and had come to embrace the existence of God. And he explained that part of the reason for this was that he had come to accept the evidence for intelligent design, in particular, the evidence for intelligent design based on the DNA molecule. Later that same year, there was a big news story about a biologist, an evolutionary biologist with two earned PhDs at the Smithsonian University, who had been demoted, evicted from his offices, and otherwise harassed because he'd chosen to publish an article advocating the theory of intelligent design in one of the scientific journals published out of the Smithsonian Institution. That was published in a journal called The Proceedings of the Biological Society of Washington. Made a big controversy. The media picked it up. By summer of 2005, intelligent design was in the news all over the place. There was a big trial in Dover, Pennsylvania, and most of the mainstream media were in a dither, really, about the theory of intelligent design, about whether or not it should be taught in the public schools, about the evidence for it, and about all the scientists who were speaking out for it and against it. And it was big, big news in 2004, 2005. By the summer, Time magazine had picked it up and had claimed in their cover story, what had by that time become the media's line on intelligent design, that it was a faith-based idea. Wired magazine said it was a faith-based plot to kill evolution, and that it was not, that it wasn't based on science at all. So what I want to ask just to start is, what is intelligent design, and what has inspired, or what about it has inspired these apparently determined attempts to suppress it? The scientist at the Smithsonian who got in big trouble for talking about this, and if you've seen the movie Expelled, you know that there are many, many scientists who have been expelled from positions, demoted, because of their support for the theory of intelligent design. So what is it? Why is it so threatening? Why has there been so much attention about it? And why is there so much attention about it again this year, as we're in this anniversary year of Darwin? This year is the 200th anniversary of Darwin's Origin of Species, or 200th anniversary of the birth of Darwin, 150th anniversary of the Origin of Species. And again, the discussion of intelligent design is front and center in the media and in many university settings. It turns out that the idea of intelligent design is not actually something new. It was, in fact, part of the assumed perspective of many of the scientists who invented modern science. One of the assumptions of the scientific revolution, that extraordinary burst of creativity that was part of Western philosophy and science that occurred between 1300 and 1700, was there was something about nature that made it intelligible, something that, because it had issued from a designing intelligence, we, as we investigated it, could see evidence of design. We could make sense of nature because nature had been designed. And you saw this point of view. It was in Kepler, it was in Copernicus, it was in Boyle, it was in Newton. And in Newton, in fact, he developed arguments for design in the optics, his great book on light and the eye, and he also developed them in the Principia, his great book on the theory of gravitation. So this is not a new idea, but it's an idea that's being resuscitated, we will argue tonight, because of new developments in science, new discoveries that have again pointed in the direction of a designing intelligence behind life in the universe. Now, the idea, though, went out of phase for a while, went out of fashion, and perhaps the most important book that put the design hypothesis on the defensive was Charles Darwin's book on the Origin of Species. And Darwin had many great ideas in the Origin of Species. He championed the idea of change over time. He proposed a new mechanism, natural selection, that I think is a real mechanism that can accomplish real things. And he also had an idea about the history of life that he proposed, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But the central legacy of Darwin's theory, and the one that's being celebrated this year in the anniversary year of Darwin's great book, The Origin of Species, is his claim to have refuted the argument from design. In fact, Darwin, in one of his letters that was published after the publication of The Origin, said, there seems to be no more design in the variability of organic beings and in the action of natural selection than in the course in which the wind blows. So though many scientists for centuries thought that their job as scientists was to detect, perceive, characterize, discover the design and order in nature, Darwin argued that there was no design in nature, that there was the appearance of design, perhaps, but no real actual design, and especially not in biology. Now, the modern neo-Darwinists, in particular, people like Richard Dawkins, who has become a great spokesman for Darwinian evolution, have championed that position, and they've made very clear this central Darwinian commitment to the rejection of design. Dawkins says that biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. 10 points on the quiz for anybody who can identify the important word in Dawkins's quote. It's obviously appearance, not design, but the appearance of design. Now, why do Darwinians say this? Why do neo-Darwinians say that there's only the appearance of design? Well, it actually makes sense if you understand their perspective. According to Darwinism and modern neo-Darwinism, there is a purely undirected process, namely natural selection acting on random variations or mutations, that can produce the appearance of design without itself being designed or guided in any way. That process is natural selection, and according to the Darwinian point of view, natural selection is a purely unguided process that can mimic the powers of a designing intelligence, but which is itself completely unguided and undirected. Now, there's an easy way to illustrate this just almost with any example of Darwinian of evolutionary change in action. But here's one I made up that I used to use with my students. Imagine you're a sheep rancher or herder up in the far north of Scotland, and you've got some sheep, and you would like to breed a woolier breed of sheep. So what do you do? Well, it's been long known that if you select the wooliest male and the wooliest ewe and only allow those two to breed, then you'll get a slightly woolier group of offspring. And if you, again, in the next generation, choose the wooliest male and the wooliest female, and you repeat that process generation after generation after generation, you can produce a woolier breed of sheep. This is a process that is often called artificial selection. The selection is being done by the intelligent rancher or breeder. What Darwin thought is that he thought, well, that's a real process, and that produces a small amount of change over time. He says, but what if instead of the rancher choosing the sheep that will be allowed to breed, what if there's a series of something like very cold winters, such that only the wooliest males and females survive, and what if that process goes on, a series of very cold winters, environmental change, generation after generation after generation? What will be the outcome? Well, Darwin argued the outcome would be that you get a woolier breed of sheep, just as in the case where you had the intelligent guidance of the rancher guiding the process. So in that case, nature does the selecting. Nature does what only previously the intelligent breeder had done. So that's the Darwinian view, that nature can produce the appearance of design. That organism looks designed because it's so well adapted to its environment, but that appearance of design is illusory. It's an illusion because the undirected action of natural forces is really what's responsible. Now, of course, the question is whether or not, and of course, natural selection is a real process and it does produce change, but the question is, can it produce every appearance of design? Can it explain every appearance of design? According to Darwinism and neo-Darwinism, it can, and so that's the first definition we need to put on the table, the idea that the appearance of design in living organisms has resulted from purely undirected natural processes, most importantly, natural selection acting on random variations and mutations. That's the Darwinian or neo-Darwinian view. Now, the theory of intelligent design challenges this central proposition of Darwinism. It challenges the idea because it says that there are certain key features of living systems, not all things. We don't deny that natural selection is a real force, but there are certain key features of living systems that can be best or better explained by the activity of a designing intelligence, not an undirected process such as natural selection acting on random variation. In other words, living systems look designed because they were designed. Hey, there's a concept. Okay, now let's clarify this a little bit. Part of the confusion in understanding the debate about design and Darwinian evolution comes from the term evolution itself, because evolution can be designed or can be defined in several different ways. The first definition is the idea of change over time. Life, and that's something that you can think of in different ways. If you look in the fossil record, we know that life is different now than it was in the lower strata. That's a form of change over time. We also see small microevolutionary changes in, for example, the finch beaks in the Galapagos finches. If you watch the weather patterns change there, you see small measurable changes in the shape and size of finch beaks. And there are other documented phenomena of that time. That's not what intelligent design is challenging. We're not challenging this first definition of evolution, of change over time. Nor are we necessarily challenging the idea of universal common descent or the idea of common ancestry. One of the things that Darwin put forward was a picture of the history of life that suggested that there were connections between organisms and that in his view, all organisms were connected on a great tree of life back to a primordial ancestor. Some of us who hold the theory of intelligent design are skeptical of this idea. Others accept it. But the point here is that that's not what intelligent design is about. It's not about challenging universal common descent. The third meaning of evolution, however, is where we think the important argument lies. And that is the claim that purely undirected processes are responsible They are the cause of the change that Darwin describes or asserts has taken place in the history of life. And of course, he said that cause was natural selection acting on random mutations. There are other evolutionary mechanisms that have been proposed. But we want to say that there are certain features of life that can't be accounted for that way, and you can tell as you examine them closely. So if you have three definitions of evolution, evolution number one, change over time, evolution number two, universal common descent, evolution number three, natural selection as the chief cause of change over time, and the cause of the appearance of design, in the theory of intelligent design is challenging that third meaning. So the real question, the fundamental question that we're addressing is the question of design and the question of whether that design is real or illusory. We want to say that there is design that is real and that you can tell when you examine the evidence. And we say that in part because there are some things that we've discovered in 150 years, in fact, in the last 30 years, last 50 years, that Darwin simply didn't know about. His theory explained a lot of things that were known in the 19th century well, but we're going to argue tonight that there are some things that Darwin did not explain and couldn't have even known about to explain. And one of them is the exquisite nanotechnology that we're now finding inside cells. Mike Behe, who's going to be speaking next, has made famous some of that exquisite nanotechnology in his book, Darwin's Black Box. Behind me is a still image of an animation of something called the bacterial flagellar motor, a rotary engine with 30-some parts with a rotor, a stator, O-rings, bushings, drive shaft, and a whip-like tail that functions like a propeller. This is just one of many nanomachines that are being found inside cells in the tiny recesses of the smallest units of life. And these tiny, tiny miniature machines are things upon which all of life depends. And we think that these things that are exquisite in their appearance of design are also better explained by actual design. And Mike will tell why when he gets up in a minute. In addition, we think there's evidence of design in the information, the digital code that's stored in the DNA molecule that is necessary to build the proteins and protein parts that make up that nanomachinery and all of the proteins that are necessary to keep life alive. And I'll be talking about that in my talk. And if you want to know more about that, there'll be more resources in the back. Mike has a well-known book called Darwin's Black Box. That'll be in the back, as well as his more recent book. And then I have a book called Signature in the Cell that develops the case for intelligent design based on DNA that will also be available. In addition, the theory of intelligent design is not just about biology, but it also says there's things about the physical universe that also point to intelligent design. This morning I talked a little bit about the fine-tuning of the laws of physics and chemistry and the very precise value of many physical parameters, the expansion rate of the universe, the strength of gravitational force, the speed of light, and how many of these parameters are very finely tuned to allow for the possibility of life. We're not going to make a positive case for intelligent design based on that evidence tonight, but there'll be, again, resources in the back that discuss that. But also, Dr. Berlinski, who will be here, will be talking about some of the attempts to explain that evidence away. One physicist, Sir Fred Hoyle, said before he died that a common sense interpretation of this fine-tuning data suggests that a super intellect has monkeyed with physics. This morning I made the quip, I like the way the monkeys always make it into the origin scenarios. And Hoyle's remark here is very suggestive because he's saying, this evidence of the fine-tuning is it's so suggestive of intelligent design that it's counter to common sense to reject it. And what Berlinski will talk about tonight as we talk to him a bit is some of the very, very elaborate and fanciful mathematical models that people have come up with to try to avoid the obvious conclusion of design in physics. And he'll talk about why some of those things actually do not work from the standpoint of physics. So we're going to look at three classes of evidence tonight, two classes of evidence from biology, one from physics. And here's a picture of the good Dr. Berlinski, who'll be joining us in a little bit. He's the author of a book called The Devil's Delusion. There are just a few copies of that in the back, and you'll be able to look at that. Well, they're already gone. Sorry, Rick. Okay, so in closing, I just want to contrast just this, some of the things I've shown just briefly with the media stereotype of intelligent design. If you've heard about intelligent design and you've only heard about it from the media, the one thing you know is that it's a faith-based idea. That's what Time Magazine said. It's a plot to kill evolution, and it's religiously motivated. It's religion masquerading as science. And the one that really hurt my feelings, it's creationism in a cheap tuxedo. There's been a lot of these kinds of objections lodged against intelligent design. But what I want you to see is that whatever it is, it's not based on religious belief. It's based on evidence that's coming out of the cutting-edge discoveries of modern science, the nanotechnology in cells, the digital code in cells, and the fine-tuning of the laws of physics and chemistry. And as we'll see later tonight, the argument for intelligent design is also based on a standard form of scientific reasoning and testing that is consistent with the scientific method. It's based on inferences about our knowledge of the cause and effect structure of the world. So the basis of intelligent design is not religion, it's scientific evidence and a scientific method, but we do admit that the theory has theistic implications. It is supportive of theistic belief, but if you doubt that it's based on, my claim that it's based on science, ask yourself the question, what caused Anthony Flew, this famous atheist, to change his mind? For him, his embrace of the design hypothesis was not based on religious belief, he had none. He was one of the world's most famous atheists, and he changed his mind, he said, based on the evidence from the miniature world of the cell and the evidence of intelligence and information in DNA. And we'll talk about both those things more tonight. And now I'll hand it over to Mike Behe, who's going to take over the first stage of making the case for intelligent design.
Throughout the second half of the 20th century, spectacular technologies revolutionized scientific understanding of the cell, the basic unit of life. During an interview with biochemist Michael Behe, Strobel learned how this new knowledge has shaken the foundations of Darwin's theory.
In the 19th century, when Darwin was alive, scientists thought that the basis of life, the cell, was some simple glob of protoplasm, like a little piece of jello or something that was not hard to explain at all. But with the hard work of science in the 20th century, we've seen that the cell is far from simple. It's got very complicated molecular machines and things that are very resistant to Darwinian explanation.
Michael Behe has devoted his career to the study of the design and operation of the cell. He has also written extensively on the biochemical challenge to evolution.
Most people have no idea of how small and complex cells are. A typical cell from you or me, called a eukaryotic cell, is probably a tenth of the size of the head of a pin. And yet, in that single cell, there are about 3 billion units of DNA making out the chromosomes. And those 3 billion units make the molecular machines of the cell, literally machines that make the cell work.
With computer animation, we can enter the cell. Here, the staggering complexity of its molecular machinery is clearly seen.
It's like going into an automobile factory. The factory has a large number of machines. The parts have to fit together in very specific ways to do their jobs. And if things go wrong, the cell is in big trouble. And just one cell is enormously complex. But humans, you and I, are made from trillions of cells. And those trillions of cells have to fit together in the right way and do their own job. Darwinism was a lot more plausible when we were thinking about globs of protoplasm than it is when we're thinking about molecular machines.
Hi, it's nice to be with you. That looks really fascinating, didn't it? Holy moly. Let me get right into it because I want to keep to the schedule and we've got lots of other folks coming up. So I'm going to talk for about 25 minutes or so on something called Answering Objections to the Argument for Intelligent Design. And that's on the slide there, if you can see it. Steve talked a little bit about what intelligent design is, but as you may know, not everybody so far has agreed with our argument, and so I'm going to address a couple objections of the more prominent objections to the idea. But before I start, since intelligent design is such a controversial topic, I want to make clear that in case you were thinking otherwise, I'm not talking officially for my university or for my colleagues. My mother disagrees with me. These are just my ideas here. Okay, so this conversation really got started in earnest 150 years ago when Charles Darwin published his book On the Origin of Species. And it was really a real very good idea and impressed a lot of people at the time and subsequently. And Darwin, like Steve was talking about, said that, well, suppose that an animal were born with a slightly increased coat of fur and it was a cold winter, then that animal would have a better chance of surviving than others of its species which had shorter fur, might be more exposed to the elements. And if it survived and if it produced offspring, then its offspring might inherit the same characteristic. And if the characteristic kept giving an advantage, then over time it would spread throughout the whole population. And it was a very good idea, and it explains many things, and it may explain many things about biology and continues to do so. But Darwin knew that although his theory could explain some things, there would be things that it'd have trouble with. And in The Origin of Species, he was talking about something called organs of extreme perfection in one section, talking about the eyeball. And at the end of his discussion of those really, really complex organs, he said the following. He wrote, "If it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down," adding, "but I can find out no such case." In this passage, Darwin was emphasizing that his theory had to be a gradual one. That is, evolution had to proceed in tiny steps over long periods of time with very incremental improvements. He knew that if animals suddenly improved in great leaps with brand new features all at once, then it would look suspiciously as if something other than random processes were involved. And so he always insisted on this idea of gradualism, very, very tiny and very slow, numerous steps. Well, okay, let's take Darwin at his word and ask, well, what sort of an organ or system could not have been formed or surely does not look like it could be formed by numerous successive slight modifications? And one such type of system is one which I call irreducibly complex or has the property of irreducible complexity. Now, irreducible complexity is a fancy phrase, but it has a very, very simple meaning. It just means you've got some system or a machine or something which has a number of different components, and the components interact with each other to perform some function that the individual components themselves can't do. Well, that's a bunch of words. Oftentimes, it's easier to grasp a concept if you see an illustration. And an illustration of what I mean by this term is shown on the next slide. And this is a mousetrap. I told you it wasn't hard to grasp. A mousetrap that you could get at a hardware store, you know, anywhere. And it turns out mousetraps have a number of different parts. Here, I'm going to use my mouse to follow along. And it's got this wooden platform here to which everything's attached. It's also got this tightly wound spring with extended ends to press against the wooden platform here, and another extended end hooking over this other metal part called the hammer. And you've got to push the hammer over, and it's got to be stabilized in position, and that's the job of something called the holding bar. And the end of the holding bar itself has to be stabilized by being inserted into something called the catch. Now, the mousetrap needs all these parts to work. If it were missing the spring, or the hammer, or the platform, or any of the other parts, you would not have a trap that worked half as well as it used to, or a quarter as well as it used to. You would have a broken mousetrap. It would not work at all, like this microphone clipping over my ear. So this is what I mean by the term irreducible complexity. So it turns out that things like this are a big headache for Darwin's theory. Because if you wanted to evolve something like a mousetrap by something like a Darwinian process, numerous successive slight modifications, you know, how would you do it? You know, what would you start with? Would you start with, say, the wooden platform and hope to catch mice inefficiently? Yeah. No, maybe you'd trip them or something like that. And then maybe you could add another part, maybe the holding bar. And then when they trip, they might impale themselves on the holding bar. Nah, that would be silly, because with irreducibly complex systems, the function only appears when pretty much the whole system's put together. So in the meantime, natural selection can't select for the function of the system. And so it couldn't be produced easily in that gradual fashion that Darwin envisioned. Well, mousetraps are very interesting. I think about them a lot. But what we really want to know is, are there any irreducibly complex biological systems? Or, since as Steve mentioned, in the past 50 years especially, science has discovered that where the rubber meets the road in biology is at the cellular and at the molecular level. Are there any irreducibly complex cellular or biochemical molecular systems? And the answer is, yeah, they're all over the place. You can't turn a page of a biochemistry textbook without running into such systems. For example, here's the flagellum that Steve talked about. This is a drawing of the flagellum from a biochemistry textbook by Vogt and Vogt, which is used widely in universities across the United States. And as he said, this is quite literally an outboard motor that bacteria use to swim. This is the part here which acts as the rotor. It's spun around and around and around in a rotary fashion. And pushes against the water and therefore pushes the bacterium forward. It's attached to the drive shaft by something called the hook region, which acts as a universal joint, allowing the rotary motion of the drive shaft to be transmitted to the propeller. The drive shaft is attached to a motor, which uses a flow of acid from the outside of the cell to the inside of the cell to power the turning of it, just like water flowing over a dam powers the turning of a turbine. The drive shaft has to poke up through the bacterial membrane, and so some parts act as bushing material to allow that to occur without leakage. And I know this looks complicated, but let me assure you, this is just a little cartoon view of the bacterial flagellum. This is much more complicated than this illustration appears. For example, an example, the parts of the flagellum are not these nice little symmetrical geometric lozenge shapes and discs and so on. These are actually constituted of very complicated molecular entities themselves, proteins, which have to self-assemble and build this rather complex structure from the inside out. Nonetheless, I think this gives you this is sufficient to get across the idea that, like a mousetrap, the flagellum is irreducibly complex. If it weren't for the hook, or the drive shaft, or the motor, or the propeller, you would not have a flagellum that spun half as fast as it used to, or quarter as fast as it used to. You would have a broken flagellum. Or much more likely, you would have no flagellum, because the cell, it turns out, has sensitive feedback mechanisms to tell it when the construction of this machine is going well or not well, and it will shut off construction if it senses that it's not going well in order to save energy. Now, I like to show folks this illustration of the flagellum, because most people, when they look at this, quickly realize that this is a machine. This is not like a machine. It is not analogous to a machine. This is a real machine. And thinking about this might let us kind of figure out how we could explain where it came from. Now, let's see, where am I? Now, as Steve said, the science in the past 50 years has discovered, much to our surprise, that the cell is based on machinery. It's like if anybody's watched Star Trek and knows about the Borg, who are these kind of half-human, half-machine-like entities, they run on nanotechnology. Well, it turns out we do too. In that sense, we are the Borg. We run on nanomachines. For example, here's an issue of the science journal Cell, a special issue on molecular machines. And if you turn the page and you look at the table of contents of this journal, you find papers with titles such as "The Cell as a Collection of Protein Machines," "Polymerases and the Replisome, Machines Within Machines," "Mechanical Devices of the Spliceosome," "Motors, Clocks, Springs and Things." So all of life, we now know, is based on these horrendously complex, elegant, sophisticated machines. Now, I wrote a book a while back, as Steve mentioned, arguing that Darwin's theory could not account for this machinery in the cell. It turns out that's not all that controversial. There are a number of scientists besides myself who agree that Darwin's theory is not up to explaining such discoveries. People like Stuart Kaufman of the University of Calgary and Lynn Margulis at the University of Massachusetts and so on. And they have their own ideas about what might replace Darwin's theory here. But my difference with them is that I've written that the best explanation for these things is that they were designed, purposely designed, by an intelligent agent. And a lot of my critics have said, and I guess I should tell you that I do have some critics, some of my critics have said, well, that Behe fellow, he's a known Christian. He has been seen entering and leaving churches. And therefore, this idea of intelligent design is a religious idea. It is not a scientific one. And then I'm letting my religious convictions interfere with my scientific work. Well, I appreciate their concern, but I disagree with them. I think the conclusion of intelligent design is completely empirical. And by that I mean that it's based entirely on the physical evidence plus standard reasoning that we make, that we use in everyday life. And as an illustration, let me show you the next slide here. This is a Far Side cartoon, if you guys know about it. And here we've got a troop of jungle explorers here, and the lead explorer has been strung up and skewered. And this fellow here turns to this guy here and says, "That's why I never walk in front." Words to live by. let me assure you. Now, everybody here looks at this cartoon, and you immediately realize that this was designed. This was not an accident. His death was intended. Now, how do you know that? Is it a religious conclusion? Oh, probably not. Probably not. No, you know it's designed because you see a number of parts interacting with each other to perform a function. Something like what I mean by irreducible complexity. And it turns out that we perceive design by something called the purposeful arrangement of parts. Whenever we see parts arranged to fulfill some function beyond themselves, we infer design. And that's what we have in spades in biology and molecular machinery these days. Well, okay, that's kind of the Cook's tour of the idea of intelligent design and irreducible complexity. Let's ask ourselves, well, what have other scientists said about these ideas? My book in which I spell these things out has been pretty widely reviewed by evolutionary biologists and molecular biologists and other scientists. What have they had to say? Well, they've had a lot of things to say, not all of them kind. Nonetheless, the most common response by most scientists is best summarized by a man named Franklin Harold, who's an emeritus professor of biochemistry from Colorado State. And he published a book a number of years ago, 2001, I think, called The Way of the Cell. And in it, he touched on the idea of intelligent design. And he said the following. He said, we should reject, as a matter of principle, the substitution of intelligent design for the dialogue of chance and necessity, and he cites my book. But we must concede that there are presently no detailed Darwinian accounts of the evolution of any biochemical system, only a variety of wishful speculations. Well, that's interesting. Let's pause here for a second. Dr. Harold makes two points, and let's look at them in reverse order here. He says that there are no detailed Darwinian accounts, no real Darwinian accounts of the evolution of any biochemical system, only a variety of wishful speculations, more colloquially known as just so stories, you know, like the stories written by Rudyard Kipling over 100 years ago, how the tiger got its stripes, how the rhinoceros got its horn, how the bacterium got its flagellum. Well, it's funny, but if you think about it a little longer, it's really astounding that a theory that has the respect of the majority of the scientific community has been so utterly fruitless in explaining the basis of life, and it makes you think that some other theory might be called for. Okay, the second point that Franklin Harold makes is that he says we should reject, as a matter of principle, intelligent design. What principle? What principle is that? You know, if you look at something like the flagellum, that drawing of the flagellum I had up, you know, intelligent design is not something that's hard to see. It pops into your mind right away, but apparently, we are forbidden from entertaining the idea of design based on some particular principle. What is it? Well, it turns out he doesn't say. He just writes those lines that I showed you, and then he goes on to other topics in his book. Nonetheless, I think I have a good idea of what he intended by that, and it's shown here on the next slide. If we could have that up for the entrance here. And that is this, that intelligent design seems to point strongly beyond nature. It seems to have philosophical, maybe even theological implications, and that kind of makes a lot of people nervous. And a lot of people think that science should stay away from theories that have such strong extra-scientific implications. Well, again, I understand that sentiment, but I disagree with it. When I was being trained in graduate school and so on, we were always told that science is supposed to follow the evidence wherever it leads. Let other people worry about philosophical or other implications. And I thought that was a good idea then, and I continue to think so. Okay, now I'm going to turn from a kind of a basic explanation of design to specific objections. And I'm going to look at, if I have time, a legal objection, and then a conceptual objection, and finally a scientific objection, if we can get to all of them. But the first one is legal. As Steve told you, in 1995, there was actually a trial in a federal court in Pennsylvania about whether intelligent design could be mentioned in a schoolroom. And it was held before this man, Judge John Jones, in the Middle District of Pennsylvania. And he ruled very strongly that no, it cannot be, because in his opinion, intelligent design is not science. Intelligent design is religion. What's more, the reasoning for intelligent design is shoddy. And he used his opinion was very strong and very well written. For example, he said the following: indeed, the assertion that design of biological systems can be inferred from the purposeful arrangement of parts is based upon an analogy to human design. Because we are able to recognize the design of artifacts and objects, according to Professor Behe, that same reasoning can be employed to determine biological design. Professor Behe testified that the strength of the analogy depends upon the degree of similarity entailed in the two propositions. However, if this is the test, ID completely fails. Oh, and I guess I forgot to mention that I was an expert witness at the trial, and I had lawyers in my face about this far for three full days. It was great fun. Kind of like going to the dentist. And Judge Jones was widely hailed for his wisdom and his strong ruling against design. And here's another man. Meet Eric Rothschild. Eric Rothschild was the lead attorney for the plaintiffs in the case, the other guys, not the side I was on. And I didn't know it, because I know nothing about law or such things, but it turns out that after a trial is over, each side presents to the judge something called a finding of law and conclusion, or finding of fact and conclusions of law, essentially in which they write what they really hope how the judge will rule, how they see things, and the way they want the judge to see things too. And actually, if you look at the judge's opinion and compare it to Eric Rothschild's written document, you can see echoes of the document in his writing. For example, Judge Jones wrote, indeed, the assertion that design of biological systems can be inferred from the purposeful arrangement of parts is based upon an analogy to human design. And Rothschild wrote, tell me if you can see this here. Look. The assertion that design of biological systems, But this wise judge knew that he should put an indeed right here, and that clearly this preposition should be upon and not on. And he continued, but Judge Jones realized that according to Professor Behe, he should go first in the sentence over here, and because should go after that. And here, Judge Jones knew that this should not be a separate paragraph. And this should have a however. whenever he was writing about expert testimony, not only about me, but about the guys on the other side, the biologists on the other side, and philosophers, academic philosophers, whenever he was talking about expert testimony, he just copied, essentially, what he was given. When he talked about the school board and what the newspapers wrote, he used his own language then. But with the expert testimony, it was cut and paste. So the point is this, that judges can't rule on the validity of intelligent design. They're certainly welcome to rule on the legality of it, but whether one explanation for the bacterial flagellum is better than another is not in the judicial province. Judge Jones, even though he had to sit through the trial, his background did not prepare him for this. He has a law background, a political background. His previous claim of fame was a stint as the director of the Pennsylvania Liquor Control Board. So the point is that you cannot surrender your judgment on these issues to somebody else, even if it's somebody as well-regarded as a federal district court judge. Okay, so that was the legal argument. How much time do I have, Ray? Another 10 minutes?
We'll stop here. Keep going.
Okay. This is the conceptual argument against design. It was first proposed by Professor John McDonald at the University of Delaware, and it has to do with the concept of irreducible complexity. Just about the day that my book came out in 1996, people were trying to see how they could build mouse traps by numerous successive slight modifications. That's a good thing to do. That's how you would attack an argument like mine. And for my money, the best one was put out by this fellow, Professor John McDonald. And he wrote on his website, which is shown up there, he showed this trap, and he said, well, this Behe guy, he said, this is irreducibly complex. It has all these five parts. You take one away, it won't work. He says, but I can take away a part, and it'll work. I can take away the catch right here. He says, I took it away, and now I put the holding bar down here, and it's just kind of tucked into the edge of the hammer. And the idea is that if a mouse comes along, this is just precariously balanced. He nibbles the cheese, this will slam shut. If the mouse is unfortunate, maybe his tail will be hanging over here. This will catch the tail. He'll have to drag the trap around behind him. You won't be able to get food as efficiently. You won't be able to attract mates. and it would work. It might be a little less efficient, but it would work. But he continued, not only that, I can take away another part, he said. I can take away the holding bar, and it will still work. He says, look, I took away the holding bar, and now the hammer is shaped so that it's just touching the edge here, and the tension is pushing it down. Again, the idea is the mouse comes along, nibbles here, this goes over the edge, this snaps down and catches a paw or a tail, and the mouse is in trouble. But he said, I can build a trap with two parts. I can take away the hammer. Now the spring itself is shaped so that it hangs precariously by the edge here, and the same thing, if the mouse came along and nibbled, it might get trapped. But he said, yes indeed, I can build a mousetrap with one part. And here it is. This is the one end of the mousetrap precariously balanced on this one, and it's under tension so that if it's released, this will go down, catch a paw or a tail here, and again, the mouse is in trouble. So he's saying that, yes, I showed a mouse trap with five parts. He can make one with one part. But nonetheless, he says something strange on his website. He says, the reduced complexity mouse traps shown below are intended to point out the logical flaw in the intelligent design argument. They're not intended as an analogy of how evolution works. Well, what does that mean? You know, if they're not intended as an analogy of how evolution works, then what's the point? And what is this logical flaw in the intelligent design argument? Well, it turns out the logical flaw, as he saw it, was that I had pictured a mousetrap with five parts. He could make one with fewer. and therefore you can make simpler mousetraps than I had pictured. And my response to that is, no kidding. You know, you can make mousetraps any of a number of ways. My family, sometimes we use glue traps, you know. My kids have a game called Mousetrap with a lot of different parts. As a matter of fact, I had said the same thing in Darwin's Black Box, in the book. I had said we need to distinguish between a physical precursor and a conceptual precursor. The trap described above is not the only system that can immobilize a mouse. On other occasions, my family has used a glue trap. In theory, at least, one could use a box propped open with a stick that could be tripped, or one can simply shoot the mouse with a BB gun. That'll show it. However, these are not physical precursors to the standard mouse trap, since they cannot be transformed step by Darwinian step into a trap with a base, hammer, spring, catch, and holding bar. The point is, we have a trap right here that we're trying to explain. Can we get to that by numerous successive slight modifications? Well, let's ask the question, using John McDonald's intermediates, can we do that? Are they numerous successive slight modifications, precursors to a type of mousetrap that he showed as the full mousetrap? And can you get there by a Darwinian process? Well, we'll go through and show that you can't, but let's look at something else on his website that should give us pause. He said, the first step in reducing the complexity of a mousetrap is to remove the catch, okay? The hold down bar is then bent a little so that it will catch on the end of the hammer that protrudes out from the spring. This end of the hammer might need a little filing to make the action nice and delicate. Now, what's the problem with this? Well, we've got John McDonald, intelligent agent, you know, re-engineering the trap to make it work. But if you use your intelligence to rearrange things, that is not a Darwinian process. Okay, well, let's look then. Let's start with the simplest mousetrap, as evolution would have to do, and see if we can go from one to the other by a random, numerous successive slight modifications. Here we start out with step one, the trap here, the one-piece mousetrap. And the first thing to say is that this is the strangest looking spring I've ever seen in my whole life. I have never seen anything like that. What's more, we can tell that it was purposely designed this way in order to act as a mousetrap. If these angles had been a little more oblique or acute, if the length of this thing was bigger or less big, this trap wouldn't work. Well, okay, you gotta start somewhere. So let's give him that, but let's say that if intelligence has anything to do with it in any other step, then we don't have anything really relevant to Darwin's theory. And intelligence comes along right away. For example, here we go from one to two. Okay, so we have a two-piece trap now with a spring and a platform, but you'll notice this is not the spring that was here. Okay, this particular arm of it has been bent by 90 degrees, and this part shortened by a considerable length. This arm here has been bent by 180 degrees and shortened considerably. So not only do we have an extra part, but we have had to re-engineer a second part. So this is just a little cartoon to show that we can't go directly from here to here. We have to have somebody engineering things in order to get to the final configuration. But we have to ask ourselves, wait a second, the spring here was intention on itself. Why doesn't the spring here kind of sprawling and relax? What's keeping it under tension? It's not hitting against another part of itself again. Well, if you look real, real close, you'll notice here's a little staple here. And here's another little staple over here. If it weren't for those staples, the trap wouldn't work. They're keeping it under tension. Not only that, notice that the placement of the staples is very important. If this staple was over here, that one over here, it wouldn't work. So we have not gone from a one-piece to a two-piece mousetrap. We've gone from a one-piece to a four-piece mousetrap, which has been re-engineered in the process. So where did those staples come from? uh, did an angel bring them from heaven? Well, no. Darwinism cannot invoke angels bringing staples for mousetraps because the angels are on our side. Okay, we go from step three to step four. This last one I'll show you here. Now we're not only adding a piece, the holding bar here, but we also have to rearrange the hammer here in order to lengthen it and give it a couple more bends and so on. Not only that, notice that the new piece is not just a flat metal bar. It's got this little curl on it, and it's hooked around this staple here. If it wasn't for that little curl, this whole trap would be useless. So not only do we have an extra part, we have re-engineering all along the way. And step four to step five, I leave as an exercise for the audience. So the point is that, we'll get to that. The point is that intelligence saturates the whole series. And that if you can't even go from one simple mousetrap to another simple mousetrap without invoking intelligence, how much more unlikely is it to go from one complex molecular machine to another? Other people have talked about mousetraps. In particular, there's a man named Ken Miller. He's a professor of biology at Brown University.
Ken Miller is one of your antagonists. He is one that's written in scientific journals about TTSS, yes?
Yes.
And explain what that is very quickly.
TTSS is the type 3 secretory system. It's a subpart of the flagellum. The flagellum, I told you, has to build itself. This thing called the type 3 secretory system can pump out the parts of the flagellum out through a hollow tube where they can assemble themselves. So it can act as a protein pump or a pump for the parts of the flagellum.
And what he's really getting at is that what he's saying is if we can show that this TTSS is a secretory, what was it, I'm sorry?
A pump.
A pump. Uh-huh. It's a building block, okay, uh-huh, of a part of the complex structure that makes up the bacteria flagellum.
Uh-huh.
And his point is if we see this in other cells or other mechanics within cells and it's pushing itself forward because TTSS appears in other type cells, then there's evidence that maybe it could have evolved to this place.
Yes.
Now, I want you to respond to that because I know that sometimes a lot of the folks that are your antagonists get to write and put their opinions in journals, and when you try and respond, your articles are...
They're deemed uninteresting.
Yes, or rejected.
Yeah, they're
which gets to a question I want to ask you. The disclaimer you gave at the beginning, was that your idea or... Do powers that be suggest strongly that you give it?
Well, a little bit of both. Powers that be thought it would be a good idea, and I agreed with them. Because you have to realize that in the scientific community, I don't get as many laughs as I get here. And my colleagues were getting static because of the crazy guy down the hall from them. And they were getting emails from other people asking if Lehigh University was turning itself into a Bible college, and graduate students from Lehigh who were going out for postdoctoral interviews were being laughed at because I am at Lehigh.
You're on the faculty.
I'm on the faculty there. So
and this is a lot of what the movie Expelled really is about. It's about some of the pressures within the scientific community to, you know, I think what they say is the science of intelligent design is neither intelligent nor science.
Yeah, they do that. They say very strongly, but they don't have any more reason for it than I've been showing you with some of the responses to my
argument. Exactly. So it gets to an ad hominem or to the man. They make these statements. They call it science in a cheap tuxedo. And yet when the evidence for that claim are brought forward, they don't stand well on the stage up against it.
No, that's correct. I mean, I'm trying to show the best responses to my arguments, and as you can see, they're just not that impressive. But nonetheless, somebody will bang a gavel, as the judge says, and said, "No, you're clearly not scientific. You know, you go away." It's more or less like people in the Soviet Union a long time ago who objected to communism, they were put in mental institutions, because if you didn't think communism was the right system, clearly you were not functioning very well. It's very similar to that.
Or you were exiled to a very cold place. Lonely place, which is a little bit of what's happening. I want to come back this a little bit. I want to get Steve back up here to talk about the evidence for intelligent design within the digital code. One last question before we move. How do I get a subscription to that Cell magazine? It just looked absolutely riveting.
Just write to MIT Press.
Okay, and that'd be, thank you. So that was flooding in on our text line, and I wanted to go ahead and get to that. If I could. All right, let's yield to Steve, and then we'll come back up, and we might look at Mr. Miller's tie clip, or do you want to give a quick explanation of what that slide was since they got a peek at it, and will Steve come out here and be ready to go as soon as you're done?
Kenneth Miller says, well, I can take away a piece, and it won't function as a mousetrap anymore, but I can use it as a tie clip. Yeah, you can, but you can't use it as a mousetrap anymore, and that's the point of irreducible complexity, and I was going to go into great detail about that, but I guess I won't.
All right. Well, we are honored that you're here. One of the reasons I'm just grateful that Mike is here, Mike is the father of 9 children, and clearly he's figured out the lack of complexity in the mating process. And that's a whole lot more fun than playing with mousetraps. Amen, brother?
You said this is a church time.
Let's, with that, Steve, talk about the evidence for design inside the code. And why don't you do this? Build this bridge, because when most of us laymen think of a black box, we think of that which is indestructible inside a plane. And that's not the black box that that Mike was talking about. He was talking about Darwin could not see what was inside the cell. He believed that, in fact, if the cell was as complex as it was today, he may never have written the book. He would have surrendered at that point and saying, there is such genius inside of that. It, in fact, violates what he wrote as in that one quote that you had from Origin of Species. So let's go further now, not just in the complex machinery that Mike talked about. Let's talk about even a step beyond, which is the digital code embedded in that. There's a segue.
That's necessary to build it.
There we go.
Absolutely. And hey, Mike, we're not used to getting that kind of a reaction. How'd you warm them up like that? All right, I'm here to talk about the digital code. I hope we get to talk a little bit more about that type 3 secretory thing later, because I've been working with one of Mike's colleagues who's a microbiologist who's been defending Mike's honor, because that There's a genetic story behind that objection that I think has shown Mike to be entirely correct, but maybe we can come back to that in Q&A. My job tonight is to talk about one of the most fascinating discoveries in the history of humankind. Not just science, but it is the discovery that Watson and Crick made of the digital code in DNA. The first thing they discovered in 1953 was the beautiful double helix structure of DNA. We all know this structure because it's a cultural icon now. We know that DNA, you convict criminals with their DNA. We see DNA on all kinds of things. The double helix is an icon, but it's a beautiful structure. But more important than the structure that Watson and Crick discovered is the mystery that they solved and the mystery that they created. First line of the book that I've just completed is this. It's when Watson and Crick discovered elucidated the structure of the DNA molecule, they solved one mystery, but they created another. The mystery that they solved was the mystery of where hereditary information arises. Since ancient times, people have known that like begets like, that children are like their parents, that organisms are able to copy and replicate themselves in very similar form. And scientists have known that there must be some kind of signal, some sort of memory that allows organisms to reproduce themselves. But where does that memory, that information, that signal reside? When Watson and Crick discovered the structure of DNA, there was a hint in the structure that suggested that the DNA not only has this beautiful helix, but it is embedding some kind of information down its spine. It was suggested by Watson and Crick in their very first paper that this might be the case. But in 1957, 4 years later, Francis Crick, having taken stock of all the developments that were going on, not only in the DNA chemistry world, but also in the world of protein chemistry, put forward what I think is really the basis of modern biology, which is the sequence hypothesis. And in it, he said that there are four chemical characters along the spine of the DNA. They're called bases or nucleotide bases that function just like alphabetic letters in a written text or digital characters in a piece of machine code or software. This is known as the sequence hypothesis. According to Crick, it's not the chemical properties of these bases that is important. Rather, it's their arrangement. Just as it's important, it's not important what the weight or the composition of these Scrabble letters is. What's important is the way they're arranged to spell out a message. It's the sequence of the arrangement that determines the function, not whether it's whether the letters are put on wood or tile or plastic. This was the sequence hypothesis. And here's a picture of the DNA molecule. You see the double helix shape. That's made of the sugar phosphate backbone on the outside. That's the medium of the genetic text, the genetic information. But the information is stored on the inside of the molecule in virtue of the specific arrangement of these particular characters. We represent them with A's, C's, G's, and T's. There are four different chemicals, and it's the arrangement of those chemicals, again, that determines the function of the molecule. Now, that's all well and good, but what exactly does DNA do? And Watson Crick said that the characters function like alphabetic letters in a written text or like digital characters in a machine code. That's great, but what does the machine code do? What do those instructions tell the cell to do? Well, right as Watson and Crick were elucidating the structure and the function of DNA, well, the structure of DNA, there was a parallel development in molecular biology in the area of protein chemistry. It started in about the same time, 1952, a scientist named Fred Sanger was discovering about the protein insulin. Other scientists began to discover the three-dimensional structure of proteins, and that they discovered that they were immensely complex three-dimensional shapes. It defied everybody's expectation. They thought proteins were going to be simple things like hat boxes stacked up on top of each other. The ultimate secret of life, after all, should be law-like and orderly. But proteins weren't like that. We know that proteins do, and they knew that proteins did lots of important jobs in the cell. You can think of proteins as like the toolbox of the cell. Inside the cell, or in a toolbox, you've got a hammer, a wrench, a saw, you've got a plane. All these things have performed functions, and they perform the specific functions they do in part because of the specific shapes they have. The same thing is true of proteins. They have very irregular, complicated shapes, and in virtue of those shapes, the proteins are able to do specific jobs in the cell. Here's just a simple illustration. You have a protein that acts as an enzyme. It catalyzes a reaction. In this case, a reaction that breaks apart two sugar molecules. But the ability to break apart that disaccharide depends on a very precise three-dimensional fit between these two molecules. The disaccharide nestles into those two grooves in this particular enzyme. And everything in biology works according to that same kind of specificity of fit. Proteins make up the structural parts of those nanomachines that Mike Behe was talking about. All those parts in the bacterial flagellar motor and other nanomachines are made of proteins. They fit together and form the machine because of very precise hand and glove fit between the parts. Same thing is true for enzymes catalyzing reactions. Same thing is true for proteins that help process the information in the cell. All proteins function because of this very precise three-dimensional specificity. How do they acquire that specificity? Well, we now know it has a hand-in-glove fit, another take on specificity. We now know that proteins acquire that specificity because of the way their individual subunits are arranged. Now, the subunits of proteins, that sounds like a big scientific word, but hey, I've got snap-lock beads tonight. Ages 2 to 4, it says on the box. Okay. All my best visual aids are stolen from small children, you know. Okay, here's a protein is a long chain-like molecule that folds into a very specific shape. and it might fold differently depending on the arrangement of the subunits, the amino acids. So each of these colored beads with a different shape represents a different amino acid. And you can see that there's a lot of different ways that we could arrange even just these few beads. Depending upon the arrangement, the shape will be different. It will fold in the protein, or the chain will fold into either a functional protein, or it may lie limp and do nothing at all if the arrangement isn't correct. So the amino acids, and there'll be a test on this particular, these equations afterwards, the amino acids are sequenced in very particular ways so that the protein folds in the right way. Get the sequencing wrong, you don't get a functional protein. So Francis Crick, in fact, said that he likened the amino acids to those old typeface blocks that are used in the old newspaper headlines. They all have the same basic chemical structure, but there's a different sticky outy with each one, a different font. And the arrangement of those sticky outies determines the, more technical term, sorry, and it determines the folding and therefore the function, okay? So we like to say that amino acids have a property, or proteins have a property called sequence specificity. If something has sequence specificity, the function of the whole is determined by the specific arrangement of the parts. We find that in language, we find that in computer codes, we find it in proteins. But the question is, how do proteins acquire that specificity? And this is where Francis Crick's sequence hypothesis came in. According to Crick, the characters along the DNA spine function like alphabetic letters, but what they're causing to happen is the sequencing of amino acids, which in turn cause the proteins to fold and therefore produce a functional tool in the cell's toolkit. So information on DNA is transcribed, translated, and produces the functional outcomes, the protein machines that the cell needs to survive. So you've got a form of functional information, sometimes referred to as machine code or assembly instructions in the DNA molecule. Now, this is what I call the DNA enigma. And I said at the beginning of my book that Watson and Crick solved one part of that enigma. They solved the question of where biological information resides. It resides along the spine of the DNA molecule. They also helped us with the sequence hypothesis to understand what that information does. It helps, it directs the building of proteins. But it raised another, their discovery raised another even more profound mystery. And that mystery is, where did that information come from? Where did it come from? Now, that's an important mystery for two reasons. First, because we know in our own digital world something about information and its importance. I actually used to ask my students, if you want to give your computer a new function, what do you have to give it? Software, code. Well, the same thing is true in life. If you want to build a new organism from an earlier, simpler organism, or if you want to build life in the first place from simpler chemicals, you have to arrange the parts in very particular ways to make functional organisms. To provide new biological function, you also need information. Same principle is in the software world. And that is a profound code is necessary to build new form and function in biology, just as it is in high technology. Now that raises a really, creates a profound dilemma. Because there's a question that scientists almost universally agree has not been solved by any materialistic theory of evolution. We can debate about whether Darwinian evolution is true or not, but I'm going to set that aside for tonight and look at a more fundamental issue. If you think of Darwin's great tree of life as representation of the history of life, all the things out on the branches, the giraffes and the dolphins and the birds and the fishes and us and plants, all of those things are the modern forms of life. But if you go back far enough, according to Darwin, you get to the simple organism that is the progenitor of all life. And he and other scientists have usually conceived of that as some kind of simple cell. Sometimes this is called amoeba to man evolution. That's not quite accurate, but you get the idea, okay? But the question that is raised by the recognition of the centrality of information is one, how do you make those transitions from one form to another, given that you need a lot of information, but to provide any new function, any new form? But an even more fundamental question And which is the one I'll talk about now, is how do you get life in the first place? Life depends on information. DNA runs the show in even the simplest cell. It directs the construction of the proteins that even the simplest cells need to survive. So where did that information come from? Watson and Crick did not answer that question, but Crick in particular appreciated the gravity of the question. Now, I first came across what I call the DNA enigma here in Dallas. I happened to be working here in the early 80s. I was right out of school. I was a geophysicist for an oil company. I learned to speak some good oil company Texan. I was looking for all out in the guff. Okay. And you know how we spell all down here. It's A-H-L, all right? And so I had no inkling of this debate. I wasn't involved in this kind of thing. I was doing practical applied science. I was looking at doing digital signal processing of seismic surveys. Interesting stuff. But one day in February of 19... that's the other anniversary. February of 1985, I walked into a conference literally off the street. I'd heard about the night before at the Dallas Hilton downtown. It was a conference that had been funded by a Dallas businessman named William Garrison. If he's here tonight or in town, all I can say is you have no idea what you set in motion. And Mr. Garrison funded this conference. It was a conference of people who held a materialistic worldview and people who held a theistic worldview, but these weren't ordinary people. These were Nobel Prize winners. They were the top cosmologists, original life scientists, and people who did neuroscience. The three questions they were addressing were the origin of the universe, the origin of life, and the origin of human consciousness. And the conference literally changed my life. I walked in, I sat down, and there was Alan Sandage in the first session announcing how he had become a religious believer because of the evidence of the new cosmology which pointed to the beginning of the universe. He had originally been slated to speak on the side of the materialist atheist position and had unceremoniously walked across to sit with the other guys. In the next session that afternoon, there was a discussion of the origin of life. There was some apparently young upstarts in the discussion, a local chemist named Charles Thaxton, who had written an important book called The Mystery of Life's Origin. And he was on the panel with Walter Bradley, a very established professor of thermodynamics and polymer scientist from Texas A&M. On the other side of the panel were leading origin of life researchers. But someone had joined Thaxton and Bradley that was completely unexpected as well. His name was Dean Kenyon. He had published the leading chemical evolutionary theory about the origin of life in a book called Biochemical Predestination. It was the leading college-level text on how life started from simple chemicals. At this conference, he announced publicly for the first time that he no longer believed his own theory. In fact, he explained why it wouldn't work, and he went on to express support for something he called the design hypothesis. And he said that he agreed with Thaxton and Bradley that the information that was required to build the cell pointed powerfully to a designing intelligence. Now, when he said that, well, you can't say this in a church, but all something broke loose. I mean, it was unbelievable. The reaction to this was part of what intrigued me, because up to that point, everyone agreed, there was no doubt about this, that the state of origin of life biology was in a state of impasse. Everyone agreed that there was no undirected evolutionary process that could explain the origin of the complexity of the cell, and in particular, this crucial information problem. By the way, nothing has changed on that. If you saw the movie Expelled last year, you saw at the very end of the film, Richard Dawkins, who is not known for his restraint and expression of support for evolutionary theory, acknowledged that no one knows how life first originated, and he meant no one knows from an evolutionary point of view. I was a young scientist, I heard this conversation, and I was absolutely intrigued. And afterwards, a local guy introduced me to Charlie Thaxton, and Thaxton was kind of unassuming and friendly. I thought, man, he'd been to Harvard, I was really kind of intimidated, but he invited me to come see him after work. And we started talking, and over the course of the next 6 months, he mentored me. And I learned more and more about this subject, and I couldn't wait to get to grad school to study it. And fortunately, the Atlantic Richfield Company made a way for that to happen by laying me off. It was, if you remember 1985, if you're oil company people, you remember what happened to the price of oil, and all the young bucks just were given very generous, but severance packages. So a year later, I found myself on my way to England. I was fortunate enough to get a Rotary scholarship from the good people here in Dallas, And I was in Cambridge my first year, and that's where I stayed to end up doing my doctoral work, and I worked on this question of the origin of life. I was intrigued by Thaxton's ideas, but he floated them not in a full book-length treatment or an argument. He floated them in a short epilogue, making a suggestive, kind of intuitive case that information seems to be the kind of thing that comes from intelligent agents. And he said, we know that based on our uniform experience. But he didn't develop this, and I was fascinated by this, and I was also fascinated by this general question, this DNA enigma. Here we had, in the shape of the DNA, the information in life, we had a feature that everyone agreed looked designed. Digital code, even Richard Dawkins says it's like a machine code, and it's uncannily computer-like, he said. But no one had an undirected process that they even claimed could mimic the powers of a designing intelligence to produce that appearance of design. So if you've got an appearance of design and no designer substitute mechanism to explain it, maybe there's evidence of actual design. And I got intrigued. But I wanted to know about the other theories. Were there other approaches that could explain this? And as I began to work on this topic during my PhD research in England, I came to realize was that this DNA was deeper and far more profound than I had any inkling of when I first encountered this conference or even in my discussions with Dr. Thaxton. What I discovered is that there were three basic approaches that scientists had taken to try to explain this DNA enigma. And the first was just the kind of the raw bootstrap, you know, seat of the pants, let's try it by chance. There was a famous French scientist who was a colleague of Francis Crick's, Jacques Monod, and he wrote a book called Chance and Necessity, and he said the basic job of the scientist is to explain everything by reference to chance, random variations, random processes, or necessity, by which he meant natural laws. If I drop a wallet here and it falls to the ground, we'll say that happened because of the law of gravity, and scientists will say that, therefore, that happened by necessity. It was lawful. It had to happen that way. And Monod basically said, that's what scientists should do. We should explain things by chance and necessity. And so I thought, well, how have scientists fared at explaining the DNA enigma, the information necessary to produce the first life by reference to chance, necessity, or as Monod said, sometimes we combine them, the combination of the two. Well, so let's look at these briefly, and you'll see why I think this is such a profound mystery from the standpoint of the materialistic evolutionary approach to the origin of life. The first approach is chance, and there's a basic problem here that was almost universally recognized, and it's the problem of the complexity of the cell, but there's a mathematical dimension to it. If you're a person of mathematical, computational, computer background, you know about combinatorials and how let me illustrate. If you've got, back to my snap-lock beads here, these represent the amino acids. There are 20 possible protein-forming amino acids that could attach to a growing chain that would build a protein at any given site. So if you have just two amino acids linking together, how many possible combinations are there? I heard a couple of math guys say 400, and that's right. Our intuition is always, it's 20 plus 20, right? But no, if you think that each one can combine with 20 others, and there are 20 possibilities at each site, it's actually 20 times 20. Now let's go and let's add another amino acid to the chain. Now how many possibilities are there? Man, this is a smart audience. Okay. I was still starting to rev up the mental math, you know. Okay, so now a fourth, what do we get? 160,000, right? Okay, and on and on. What's happening to these numbers? Are they building just, are they going up in an additive fashion or a geometric or exponential fashion? Okay, exponential. Now, I'm going to look really smart because I already figured this out. Okay, all right. A modest length protein is going to be in the order of 150 amino acids long. The cell needs many proteins that are much longer than that, the gigantic polymerases, for example. But let's just take a modest length protein of 100, 150 amino acids long. Now, what? Think of the combinatorial problem that we have. That's the number of possible arrangements of amino acids that you could generate. 20 times 20 times 20 times 20 times 20 out to the 150th power. 20 to the 150th is also, now this is where I get to look smart, 10 to the 195th power. I worked that out on my little calculator beforehand. But the point is, that's an unimaginably large number. Now, you can quibble about that, and you can notice that there's more than just one functional protein, and that's correct. So that adjusts the numbers downward. But then you also have to take into account that there's only a certain kind of linkage that can take place chemically, and the odds of that are only 1 in 2 at each site. And there's only one kind of amino acid, a left-handed, not a right-handed kind. And so when you take it all into account, here's the bottom line. The number of combinations of possibilities vastly dwarfs the number of possible events there could have been since the very beginning of the universe, since the Big Bang. There are only 10 to the 80th elementary particles. There are only 10 to the 16th seconds since the beginning of the universe. There's only so fast that interactions can take place between molecules. So think of it this way. All the number of combinations that could possibly be represent a vast haystack grander than the size of the entire universe, and what we're looking for is something like a tiny, tiny needle smaller than the smallest elementary particle. And we have to find that in a blind, undirected search, all right? Most scientists working on the origin of life have realized that the complexity of the cell, the combinatorial complexity, is so great that we will never, ever find life in that way.
Through time plus chance.
Through time plus
chance.
What
you're saying is statistical improbability, giving the grandest, number that is presented as a probability for the existence of the universe, which is right around 13.7 billion years right now, I've read recently, correct?
Right, right.
And so you're saying that there's no way for just this one expression of creation to have taken place statistically within that time period, given the immensity of the probability.
The odds are always better that it didn't happen by chance than that it did, and they're immensely in favor of that it didn't. The probabilities are so small.
And what's happening and so exciting inside the black box, so to speak, is what we're seeing is that scientists, everywhere they go, they keep seeing more and more overwhelming evidence that there is just no way that this could have evolved or happened. The numbers are so grand, it takes not just a tremendous amount of faith, but it goes against all reason, all probability, and all really scientific possibility that it could have happened that way, and yet they still defend it vehemently.
Right, because there are some other possibilities, but let me turn the corner from the negative to the positive, okay?
And I just want to make you aware, I know David's here. It is 8:40.
8:40.
And so we need to get him out here.
5 minutes, and I'll tell you the end of the story.
Okay.
And then we'll get him out.
Go for it.
Okay.
I'll stay here with you.
There's two other... And he's a big guy. I'm not going to mess with that. Okay. Let me turn that. There are other possible purely naturalistic approaches. In my studies, I found them equally inadequate. And if you want to know why, there's a big fat book that we're advertising in the back that's going to be out in June called Signature in the Cell. But I want to tell you the positive side of the story, and this will segue to David. Okay, and that is that I had an epiphany because one of the things I want to know is, was Dr. Thaxton right? Could this be made a scientific conclusion, the idea of intelligent design? And when I got to Cambridge, one of the things I began to study was, how do scientists reason about events in the remote past? And I found the works of the masters. I found the works of Charles Darwin. And I found the works of his mentor, Charles Lyell. And they had a simple principle, and it was that if you want to explain events in the remote past, you should invoke causes that are known to produce the kind of events that you're trying to explain. Makes sense? You want to explain volcanic ash? Don't invoke an earthquake. Invoke a volcanic eruption, right? And so I one day found the front piece on Lyell's book, okay? And this is what it had this amazing subtitle, and it put the light on for me. It said, Principles of Geology being an attempt to explain the former changes of the Earth's surface by reference to causes now in operation. That's how we got to go about things. We try to explain things by reference to causes that we know can produce the effects in question. And I asked myself a simple question. What is the cause now in operation for the production of digital code? What is the cause now in operation for the origin of information? I knew that chance, necessity, the combination of the two didn't work. I studied them carefully. Nobody disagreed with me, not even the good Professor Dawkins, as late as last year. But there is a cause that we know can produce digital code. That cause is intelligence. We're doing it right now. I'm conveying information to you. It's maybe not an intelligent design, but at least some kind of mind is behind all this communication. Okay? So what I realized, oddly, was that Darwin's own method of reasoning, where we infer the cause which is known to produce the effect in question, is the best explanation of the thing we're trying to explain, that his method actually revived the argument from design. The data were different, the conclusion is different, but using his method, which I honored and followed, I came to the conclusion that the best explanation of the digital code that's involved in life, the central feature of living systems, has to come from an intelligence. And that is the basis, not of just a critique of evolutionary ideas about the origin of life, but a positive case for intelligent design based on an established scientific method of reasoning, in fact, Darwin's own method. That's my story.
Wonderful. All right. Yeah. All right. I want you all to hang in there because what we're going to do in these next 17 minutes, David Berlinski, who is here with us, is going to basically do a little interview right now with Steve. And I want you to stick with this. We're going to do this for about 15 minutes. Then we're going to bring up Mike and maybe Ray and do a short Q&A. Are you guys ready? Come on out here, David. Come on out here, Steve. This is going to be a real treat. If you've We're going to forgo the video introduction of Dr. Berlinski, and the reason I want to do that is to maximize our time with him. Let me just recommend that all of you go and watch the movie Expelled, and it does a great job of introducing Dr. Berlinski. I'm grateful for his being here. He's come all the way from France, and so Steve, I'm going to let you have a few minutes with him, then we're going to come back up here and crank out some more great time. So
that's great.
Welcome.
I'm delighted to have David here tonight. He and I are colleagues at the Discovery Institute. He's also a friend and advisor. He's the Jewish uncle I never had but always wanted. And we have had a lot of fun working on this issue together. David has a fantastic book out called The Devil's Delusion, which is out of print. And there's some publishers looking at it, trying to get it back into print. You may have heard a little bit about it this morning. But David's background is as a mathematician and as a philosopher. And David, you became skeptical about Darwinian evolution fairly early on, well before, you know, there's a country song down here that says, I was country before country was cool. You were skeptical about Darwin before there was any ID movement, and what were some of the considerations that led you to that?
Well, let me impart a secret. I published my first paper that dealt directly or indirectly with Darwinian evolution, 1973. Long time ago. And I published it directly because I had been thinking about topics in automata theory, machine theory. And I was very much influenced by mathematical linguistics. My great buddy Marco Schutzenberger was a mathematician, and Noam Chomsky and Schutzenberger were working together on the description of natural languages by a formal mathematical method. And I tried to apply exactly the same description of certain structures in the English grammar to what I then, in 1973, understood about molecular biological systems. And what did I discover? That it was impossible, not just difficult, but impossible to use the simplest level of explanation, so-called finite state automata, where one thing happens after another. Typical Darwinian progression, small incremental continuous improvements in the structure of an organism. As soon as you tried to specify that very rigorously, you discovered, well, it doesn't work. It doesn't look good. It doesn't make sense. What you need is at least, and this was 1973, all this is far in the past now, and I'm sure the methods have been improved, but I think the conclusion is sound. You need at least what's called a push-down storage automata. You need some forward-looking memory. Let me give you a simple example. You take the English sentence, the old man came, and you can say that sentence is made by first fishing the word the from a vat. And that word determines the next one. It can be old, sprightly, courteous, ancient, whatever. But it determines the next word. And then the third word, man, is determined by the second word, and the verb at the end is determined by the third word. Very simple system. It's a very Darwinian system. You can imagine Darwinian evolution producing the sentence, the old man came. Turns out English doesn't work that way, and no other natural language does either. For example, the old man who had snorted the roses in the hall came. Now listen to the balance of that sentence. The old man, comma, who had snorted the roses in the hall, comma, came. There is no immediate dependence. When you get to the verb, you have to go all the way back to the beginning of the sentence and keep that in memory before you'll understand what the sentence says. that can't be produced by a Darwinian mechanism or a finite state automata. And the great work in this field was done by Noam Chomsky as early as 1958 or 59. It was a revolution in graduate school when I was there. Just amazing. And contrary to what all the behavioral psychologists thought, and behaviorism in psychology is simply Darwinism in psychology, contrary to what all the people like B.F. Skinner thought, or W.V. O'Quine, a great philosopher, English and no other natural language behaves in this way. You need something like a push-down storage automata for a formal description. And of course, that set my imagination on fire. You had your experience, yeah. I had mine, and I got together with a very good biochemist, George Pechenik, and we were going to publish revolutionary papers and nothing ever happened.
Ruin your careers in so doing, yeah.
Oh, Pechenik went on to a great career, but he didn't go on to a great career criticizing Darwin, that's for sure. He's some bigwig in an oil company. Oh, amazing, an oil company. Yeah,
yeah. I'm intrigued by this phrase, forward-looking memory, because one of the things that the mechanism of natural selection can't do by definition...
No, absolutely impossible.
...is have foresight. And yet every simulation that's done in a computer of Darwinian evolution seems to require that foresight. Can you tell us a little bit about
that? It is assiduously packed into the simulation itself. I mean, I think we can say as a kind of general principle, where Darwinian computer theoretic simulations work, they're not Darwinian. And when they don't work, what they require is the addition of forward-looking memory, some capacity to store information about the future. This is simply missing from Darwinian theory. It's absent a concept. There's a hole where there should be something substantial. And it's not a trivial hole. It's a very significant hole.
Richard Dawkins, I think the two of you have debated in the past, but he has a simulation where he attempts to do this, where he wants the computer to produce the phrase, "Me thinks it's like a weasel," but tell us.
I wrote about this before Dawkins published his stuff, and many, many people were arguing like Dawkins. Dawkins has become the most well-known, indeed notorious. He took a phrase from Hamlet, "Me thinks it's like a weasel," and he said, how would... It's an ironic phrase for Richard Dawkins to use. God punishes every man according to a special plan. And he said, what would be required in order to achieve this sentence from a random group of letters or words using just Darwinian principles? And he said, well, suppose we set up a computer and we randomly varied a sample sentence, which was just gibberish, and every time we accidentally came close to the sentence, the target sentence, methinks it's like a weasel, we would keep those changes and allow the computer simulation to go on until we converged to the target sentence itself. And of course, he was able to show with no very great difficulty that indeed, using those constraints, you could achieve convergence to a target sentence much more quickly than you could by looking at it randomly. I never understood
what's the fallacy in that, though?
I'm not sure it's a fallacy, because obviously his theory is correct. It's simply not Darwinian, because what he has, speaking technically, is a built-in metric, which is just a way of measuring the distance between what he gets randomly and what he needs to get. And speaking informally, he has a fixed goal in mind. Now, not necessarily the goal of that sentence, but if you disregard that goal and say, well, any English sentence will do, the problem becomes progressively more difficult, not less difficult, because then you have to build in constraints which will tell you when you've reached an English sentence and when not, and no one knows how to do that.
So he's selecting for future function, not actual function.
It's all taking place in the future.
As if the computer somehow knows, which, of course, natural selection doesn't know.
No, but the rest of life does.
Yeah, the rest of life does, yeah. As one of our colleagues, Paul Nelson, says, if you get it wrong, the life has a way of talking back. It says, hey, I needed that. I'm dead.
Exactly. So I published that criticism, and people who understood the discussion agreed with me. Mm-hmm. And, of course, people who didn't. Ça va sans dire.
David, let's talk a little bit about your the Dawkins is also known for this book, The God Delusion. There's this whole publishing phenomenon of the new atheism, and you've written this wonderful piece, the Devil's Delusion: Scientific Atheism and Its Pretensions. Why did you decide to take these guys on?
I wrote a book called The Devil's Delusion: Atheism and Its Scientific Pretensions, and question is, why did I decide to take these people on? I'm assuming that vanity is not the answer you wanted. But look, we're among friends, right? And vanity is a part. Anybody who writes has that as a motive. I'm not trying to present a false face. It's not false humility. Yeah, I wanted to get my name known. I wanted to make a big stir. I wanted to attack these guys. And that is the expression of vanity, nothing else. But I also thought this is an important topic. I still do. And I wanted to register not necessarily a dissident, but a different opinion. And that's what I set about doing in the book. And I think a different opinion, a heterodox opinion, is badly needed because atheism has become, in the secular West, certainly in France and in the rest of Europe, I don't know about Eastern Europe, but in Western Europe, in the United States, it's become the default position among intellectuals. Not only the default position that is instinctively reached, but an unthinking position. By unthinking, I mean it's not historically informed and it's not analytically informed either. And people who espouse atheism, say over cocktail parties or dinner parties at Cambridge or San Francisco or New York, are typically flabbergasted to discover that their beliefs are wafer thin and their arguments are generally puerile. And I wanted to say that.
It was a good time for a dramatic pause just to reflect on that last phrase. That was wonderfully stated. David,
I'm sorry, I can't see.
Yeah, David had a fall and has got a
defeating a terrorist plot.
Yeah.
I happened to trip over my own feet.
I was talking a little bit this morning and did in my introduction about the argument from design based on the anthropic fine-tuning, all this exquisite fine-tuning. And one of the things that, one of the counter-arguments to that is the idea that there were billions and billions and billions of other universes out there, these various physical models that generate the what's called the multiverse. And you talk in your book a bit about the multiverse. And what's your assessment of that as a contrary hypothesis?
Well, you need a special scale to rank the multiverse, the scale of the preposterous. If the doctrine that we all have parents who were ducks comes in at 100, the multiverse comes in at slightly more. It is one of those strange phenomena in the history of thought. I mean, you see, the most intelligent people on the planet, and that's sincerely meant, these guys who are doing quantum cosmology.
They're smart.
Very smart, yeah. Very smart. Nonetheless, like a herd of individuals, they all are instinctively moving toward the same conclusion, which involves embracing any doctrine, hypothesis, or belief other than the most obvious one. It's a remarkable feat, not of indoctrination. Nobody is forcing these guys to do that, but of compliance to a party line. And the party line is, God forbid we should mention anything except a hypothesis that does not invoke a designer or some form of supreme intelligence or some transcendental entity, anything except the obvious one. And they are reacting this way because they've been properly chastened. You know, when the Big Bang hypothesis became more than a hypothesis, when it became part of the settled body of theoretical physics, a great many physicists said, you know, the universe came into existence 15 billion years ago. It sort of erupted into existence from nothing. And some of the physicists with more than a nodding literary acquaintance with the great texts of Western history said, you know, I've heard that before. Can't place it, but it's got that ring in the beginning. And they began talking amongst themselves. And one of the physicists said to the other, you know, that's something that was written a long time ago, not only in one place, but in every single serious creedal system, there is reference to the event by which the universe was constructed, and it's remarkably similar to what modern physics shows. That was too much for the community of physicists. It was really an indignity. First of all, that a lot of dopey theologians may have anticipated the Big Bang. What an outrage. Chutzpah, as we say in Greek. That couldn't be. Antaldi. But in the second place, it conflicted with everything the community, the scientific community in the West, took to be their prerogative. They would decide what the physical world looks like. They would answer all questions. To the scientists would repair all inquiring intellects, and anybody who didn't like it, well, just too bad. And here is a conclusion that didn't seem quite agreeable. So an incredible amount of effort has been devoted, say, since 1971, 1972. How many years is that?
37, something, yeah.
I don't do that kind of math.
It's okay, neither did Einstein.
Yeah. We're brain workers. We leave that to other people. An incredible amount of work has been devoted to rejecting this palpable and obvious conclusion. Well, if you find the existence of the universe a remarkable mystery, some sense of that mystery can be dispelled if you say to yourself, it's not just one universe. There are all sorts of universes lying around out there, loitering, as it were. And there's nothing mysterious about our universe, because any property that we find desperately enigmatic about the world in which we live is sure to arise by chance, just so long as we have sufficiently many universes to make the play of the dice agreeable. Hence the hypothesis that we live not in the universe, but in one universe, and that there are indefinitely many other universes out there. And that principle, the doctrine of the multiverse, multi-universe, goes along with a number of other nonsensical doctrines, the anthropic cosmological principle, for example. And this is not the time, I think, to go on an extended exploration of the anthropic cosmological principle, nor the doctrine of the multiverse. My point is otherwise. I think you have a genuine example in the flight of the community of physicists from any confrontation with the obvious to a variety of metaphysical speculations that strain credulity of a relatively familiar phenomenon in the history of thought, that is party line orthodoxy. We've seen it with Marxism. We certainly saw it with Freudianism. And it continues to this day within the sciences. Very interesting.
David, some of these physicists have been quite candid about their reasons for positing this. There's a quote in your book from Leonard Susskind.
Leonard Susskind is a terrifically smart mathematical physicist at Stanford, you know, very aggressive, Brooklyn-born, nothing but contempt for anyone else. He said, if we don't come up with the right scenario, these guys are going to crucify us. And by us, he means the physicists, and these guys, he means people like Steve and me. He's absolutely right.
Yeah, if it's not the multiverse, he says it's intelligent design, and we simply can't have that.
No, so, unacceptable.
So there's got to be billions and billions about the universe.
I heard Dr. Berlinski mention clueless theologian, and I felt like that was my invitation to join you all. I'm not sure I am the latter, but I'm definitely the former.
You can stay standing if you like.
Let me ask this. I think the reason we had such a great response, and this is a key question, if you can only hear one, I want you to hear this. I think the reason there was such a tremendous response tonight is because people who have believed in a creation explanation have been bullied by science for the better part of the last 150 years. They've been told that they are infantile in their understanding, that they're anti-intellectual, and that they believe in a child's fairy tale. So what would you say to them? Because clearly we're not scientists, and we cannot enter into a conversation to tit for tat on science, but to folks that have felt oppressed by this idea that only fools believe in the myth, the God delusion, if you will, what would you say to them?
First thing I would say is, so what? Infantile, narrow-minded, foolish, childish, okay, so. The question isn't whether it is infantile, childish, narrow-minded, whether it's something that could not expect to see in sophisticated circles. Those are points in its favor. Surely we understand that. The question is, what portion of the truth resides in these claims? That's a different question.
Okay. And so what you're saying, though, from a scientific perspective, that the truth is overwhelmingly crying out for this intelligence, this singularity, which is intelligent.
No, I'm not saying anything from the
scientific
perspective.
I didn't think so, which is why I asked.
Because the... There is no such thing as a scientific perspective. There is only the perspective of informed, commonsensical, rational inquiry.
Wonderful.
There is no method of science. I mean, nothing that doesn't apply to golf as well. The whole thing is a charade to that extent. It's a structure of considerable grandeur but great emptiness. There are various scientific theories, and our responsibility, and I mean everybody in this audience, me, you included, is to examine these theories and ask ourselves as honestly as possible, do they answer to the deepest needs of men and women? If not, get rid of them.
Steve if and Mike?
So, yeah, exactly. What's wrong with that? We're looking at certain theories. Mike Behe's looking at theories in molecular biology. Steve is looking at information. As it's applied to these systems, I have slightly different interests. And if we come up with conclusions that are not entirely consonant or consistent with the standard scientific orthodoxy, tant pis, tough.
Todd, I think one of the wonderful things about the book that you're holding in your hands, granted it's
yeah. You can't buy it. And it was interesting, David, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the reason this is out of print, usually books go out of print because no one's buying them.
No, it's sold out. That's why it went out of print.
And so why doesn't the publisher who wants money, why don't they put it back in print?
They don't like my associations.
Yes. In other words, they are embarrassed that this would be put off as science underneath their...
No, just embarrassed because of my association with the Discovery Institute.
Okay.
Simple as that.
Can I say something for the book, though?
Sure.
Well, I think the short answer to your question is it's time to stop being intimidated. And I think the devil's delusion is a lucid, short, very readable, very funny, but very persuasive and powerful defense of that common sense principle. You know, the people that obscure common sense with talk of multiverses and quantum cosmological ideas and string theoretic landscapes, it's time to stop being intimidated by folks like that and ask, well, do these things really make sense? And
I think
David
does
a masterful job of deflating the pretensions that underlie a lot of that kind of obfuscation.
I think Dr. Johnson made the point superbly. You know, he was talking to Boswell and he said, sir, you must clear your mind of Kant. Stop talking rubbish if you can possibly help it. The scientific community talks a lot of rubbish. Look, they're only human. There's nothing wrong with talking rubbish, but there's nothing wrong with pointing out that it is rubbish either.
Yeah. All right. I want to get this. I don't want to miss it. Steve, earlier you said there's three different definitions of evolution. And the second one, I think, created a little bit of a stir when the idea that we don't have an issue with common descent or common ancestry. And explain that. That doesn't mean that you believe that all of us have come from, all the kinds have come from a similar kind, or does it? I want to let you speak to that.
I have an issue with universal, I think I've got, you got me hooked up, David, but I have an issue with it. I know too much about fossils, for example. The major groups of organisms come suddenly into the rock record, the insects, the phyla in the Cambrian. I used to say to my students, you shall know them by their euphemisms. The Cambrian explosion, the marine Mesozoic revolution, the angiosperm big bloom, the mammalian radiation. I don't think there's good evidence for universal common ancestry. But the point I was making is that that's not what the theory of intelligent design is addressing. We're addressing a different question. We're addressing a more fundamental issue of whether there is or is not design in life and in the universe, and whether or not you can tell from the scientific evidence. So there's three facets of Darwinism: change over time, universal common ancestry, and the idea that a purely undirected mechanism produces the appearance of design. We're taking on that third, and we think most fundamental and important proposition. Once we get that one settled, the rest of the stuff will fall in place.
Mike, do you want to jump in on that at all?
The reason we focus on just the point of intelligent design, or at least my reason, is that it's the easiest. It's the easiest. If you can remember to my talk, I showed the Far Side cartoon with the jungle trap. And you can ask yourself a whole lot of interesting questions that you'd like to know the answer to. Like, who made that trap? You know, maybe it was a native of the jungle. Maybe it was one of the explorers. You know, and the guy who turned around and said, I wasn't in front. I didn't want to be in front. Or when was it made? Maybe it was made yesterday or a month ago. So you can ask a lot of who, what, when, where, how questions, and you need more information to answer those. But simply looking at the system right there in front of you, you look at that trap, and immediately you know it was designed. Because the evidence for design is the system itself. The history of the system and so on is an interesting question, but you can tell that something was designed just by essentially looking at it. And so it's the easiest question to address. It's also the one that the evolutionists, the Darwinists, most want to avoid. They'd be happy to talk about any other question except how in the world could these complex machines and systems have come about without intelligence.
Because undirected natural cause is the foundation of Darwinian theory and science.
Absolutely.
So, Dr. Blinsky?
Well, if you'll permit me, I have a slightly different perspective on that question, but I think the question is essential. Just imagine you're walking in the desert, and you're walking with a Darwinian biologist, and you come across a termite mound. You know, termite mounds are fairly complicated structures. They have many tunnels. They have elaborate construction. You say to the Darwinian biologist, how did that come about? And he says, well, the termites made it. Good answer. The termites did make it. The termites are perfectly capable of making termite mounds. You go a few miles further, and you come across a nuclear fusion reactor, a massive thing sitting there in the desert, gleaming pipes, ducts, ceiling, waterworks, producing steam, generating electricity. And you turn to the Darwinian biologist and you say, you know, here we are in the desert, there's a nuclear fusion reactor. How did that come about? And the guy says, well, termites made it. You know that's not the right answer. You just know that's not the right answer. But the interesting case is one intermediate between these two. You're in the desert again and you see something. Aren't you all I'm going to tell you? You see something. And you turn to the Darwinian biologist and said, how did that appear? The guy says it was the Darwinian process. What's wrong with that answer? Which is the answer that has been classically given by Darwinian biology. What's wrong with that answer is the description, I saw something, is not complete enough. It's not specific enough so that any answer is logically possible. In that sense, when Darwin proposed a mechanism for evolution in 1859, he was looking through the wrong end of the telescope. Because we have not, 150 years later, been able to specify the structures in the cell with that degree of sophistication and precision that would enable us to say, yes, that was a Darwinian process. Darwin was looking through the wrong end of the telescope, so are Darwinian biologists. The question that Darwin attempted to solve may be perhaps solved in 500 years. Now is not the time when it admits of a solution. We have not been able scientifically or rationally to describe the structures that we see, certainly not in molecular biology. The only honest thing that we can say is they're stupefying in their complexity. But if they're stupefying in their complexity, we cannot characterize that complexity. There is no theoretical model that is adequate to the task of explaining their emergence. That's a logical point. I think it's a powerful point.
And what you're saying is you don't need to be a scientist to grasp that. It is in your face, and in fact, all the mountain of words in theory does is obscure the obvious.
I think that's largely true. Anybody who's looked in the eyes of an infant knows that's true. No way to characterize the intelligence that one sees there.
Can I cue David up on another aspect of this common ancestry question? The poster child of transitional intermediate forms in Darwinian biology today is the transition from a hippopotamus-like land-dwelling creature to the modern whale. And David has asked some, I think, penetrating questions about the plausibility of that having to do with the anatomical changes that would be required. What could you say about that?
I've been thinking about this and remarking casually about this for about 20 years, ever since I first heard this incredible scenario that the whale, huge big thing, lives in the ocean, had its origins in some dim, dweebish, land-going, grass-munching creature. I said on the internet once it was probably a cow, and everybody, oh, no, what do you know? It's not a cow at all. It's a moose. I don't care what you call it. The question is, what does it take to transform a land-dwelling creature into a sea-dwelling creature? Or, if you want an analogous question, what does it take to transform a 1976 Chevrolet Camaro into a submarine? It's the same question. It's the same question.
Or an ape to a man?
No, this question is more specified because we have a much better intuition about the changes. We know just what it would take a Camaro and make a submarine, a whole lot of work. But my question wasn't that this story was plausible or implausible. I have no interest in that question. My question was rather, do we have any quantitative measure of the number of changes, just anatomical changes? After all, we take a cow or a moose, the first thing we got to do is make it waterproof. How do we go about making a mammal waterproof? Not a simple business. The skin is a complicated organism. How do we teach it to breathe 500 miles under the water? How far down do whales go? I'm in the ballpark, yeah, right? How do we get its blow spout or whatever those things use to the top of its head from the bottom of its head? How do we persuade this creature to give up eating grass and go munch whatever whales munch? Can we come up with a numerical estimate of the number of changes? And I said, you know, I have no idea. These are very complicated questions in morphology and comparative anatomy. But I was able to say, well, you know, back of the envelope, about 50,000. Say it's wrong. Say it's 5,000. 500,000. I don't know, but you don't know either. The point is, when you go to the paleontological textbooks, the question, how many fossils do we see that fit this pattern? And how many fossils might we expect rationally to fit this pattern? That question is never asked. Never asked. You go to the leading experts on chordate paleontology, James Carroll, a wonderful scientist. I looked through his textbook. Yeah, I understand there are all sorts of intermediates like Ambulocetus natans that have been discovered, and those are wonderful confirmations of Darwinian theory. There is an intermediate sequence, but there are only 7 of them. If there are 50,000 changes, what happened to the remaining 49,000 changes that should be in the fossil record? Can we explain that away? Is it plausible? It is plausible. My point is the question is not properly asked. It's a sign of intellectual flabbiness in Darwinian theory. One of many.
Okay, guys, we're going to end at 9:15. We're going to make ourselves more available. I want to say we're going to throw Ray to the lions. Here we've got this panel of 3, and then it's going to be Ray alone on Tuesday. So you're going to have all those text messages to chew through and get after it. But Ray is a very capable scientist and philosopher and able to do that with us. Now, here's the last 2 questions I want to ask. One, what is the best argument against intelligent design?
Look around.
People? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. The world.
Yeah.
Oh, go ahead.
Well,
Mike.
The argument from evil comes up quite a bit.
And one of the things that's not... Well, go ahead, Mike. Are you going to expound on that?
Yeah. Why did my mother die? I've had people ask me that, and they say, you say that this was designed. My mother died of cancer last year. How could that be designed?
Yeah. How could an intelligent, especially a benevolent designer, as the Christian would represent, or the theologian, be any part of this design? So it's really a question of theodicy more than it is a question of creation.
They're of a part, these questions. We find it very difficult to reconcile ourselves with the world as it is. There's no question that as human beings we do. Sin and suffering are overwhelming.
We were talking today.
Can I take a stab at that about the rhetorical framing of that? That question is put to us, obviously raises a theological question. There's an artificial restraint on the debate that says that anything that has a theistic implication is not scientific. You know, so people they think when they raise that question that there's a kind of a gotcha for anyone who's in favor of intelligent design. But I think to answer that, you have to bring in a theological perspective. And I think the Judeo-Christian biblical perspective is that you ought to expect 2 things in life, not 1. You ought to expect evidence of design, but you ought to expect evidence of decay as well. There's something wrong with the world that wasn't intended. And if you're artificially prevented from giving a theological answer to what is in essence a theological question, then the ID perspective always looks deficient. But if we get rid of that artificial restraint and say we're going to follow the truth wherever we happen to find it, whatever disciplinary heading it falls under, whether that's science, philosophy, theology, I think there are reasonable, coherent perspectives
on that. There's an even better answer. It's an answer to the question, why is man's lot so miserable? Where wert thou when I created the universe?
Yeah. So you're saying the question that God himself asked to Job, where art thou? And so who is this that darkens counsel with words without knowledge?
Exactly. That will do as well as any other answer, right? I mean, there are questions we can't answer.
Yeah, it's interesting. One of the other famed neo-atheists today is, we've already mentioned him, is Hitchens, Christopher Hitchens. And I was recently in a room with Hitchens where he himself said, to your point, Steve, leaving the discussion about evidences for origins, if I was going to suggest there's a problem with your designer, it's the way that he lets this world drift to decay. But he said, I would agree that if the Christian story was proven to be true, it gives a compelling and acceptable explanation for the problem of evil, a congruent explanation of which I provide no other. But because I reject the Christian explanation, I therefore reject the whole thing out of hand. But he himself acknowledges if the theistic answer is true, it does answer the question that's presented to intelligent design.
Coherent. It's amazing some of the concessions that are granted on the ride home from the debate with these guys. I mean, I could tell you some interesting stories. So the difference between the podium presentation and what one of my students called the 4 o'clock in the morning questions, they have them too.
Yeah. That's true for every participant in the debate. Yeah. Everybody feels the same way. What we say in public, we say with enormous confidence. What we say to ourselves at 4 o'clock in the morning is full of doubt and uncertainty.
Let me just do this. To honor your time and theirs, let's just join them in an expression of thanks for their stewardship of life and time this evening. Yeah, gentlemen, I think the response that you're getting right now is really an expression of, I think, the relief that Dr. Blitz, you said you shouldn't feel this. I mean, trust yourself. Don't let us overcomplicate things that are self-evident. Look at the baby, which is really an argument from Psalm 139. That you can see what is there. But I think what you're hearing us say is you guys can look through telescopes and microscopes that we cannot and have discussions on a field which we are not welcomed into. And what you're saying is even there, you have no reason to shrink back. And that is our expression of thanks for your serving well on a portion of the battlefield that we have not been asked to march. I would encourage you to take advantage of the work that these men have done through the devil's delusion, through the signature of the cell, through Darwin's black box. Find these materials, avail yourself to them, use their arguments, and let them argue with their PhDs. Let them argue with the Nobel scientists that are on the Descent from Darwin list and others that themselves have made the case that you cannot make from a lack of investing and stewarding your life that way. You have gifts, you develop them, and you put them to work as these men had, and others will be as encouraged by you as you have been by them this evening. So may they stand before you and applaud you for your faithfulness, for being effective in the battle that you are in. And again, men, we want to thank you and express our heartfelt thanks by both reading and learning from your materials, making ourselves attentive to them, and by laboring in our part of the battlefield. One last time, we thank you for coming. And we'll see you on Tuesday. And thank you. Have a great evening. Bye-bye.